Participants at today's graduation ceremonies at Girard College heard from commencement speaker and 1999 Girard College alum, Dr. Marcus Anthony Hunter, now Associate Professor of Sociology at UCLA and author of the book entitled Black City Makers, How the Philadelphia Negro Changed Urban America. Marcus, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
I'm very happy to be here.
And what an historic week to address the student body, the passing of Muhammad Ali, mm-hmm. Donald Trump's racist comments, mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton breaking through a glass ceiling. Mm-hmm. What was part of the message that you try to impart today?
Yeah, it's really to really think about the graduation and looking at all of the students, especially given that Girard College is a predominantly Black student population, to really take in the history that, for me, they represent. That, you know, beginning with Dr. Nathan Mosel, who was the first Black medical doctorate out of the University of Pennsylvania and the founder of the Frederick Douglass Memorial Hospital, he began in 1900 trying to protest the segregation of Girard College. So I sort of think about 2016 as 116 years after that experience, that he would be so proud to see this group of beautiful Black kids living this dream, because for many Black people who lived on the outside of the wall, they would look and be imagining, wow, there are these trees and squirrels and his gate. There must be this amazing opportunity on the other side. And so, as we all know, in the 60s, they marched around that wall to get that. And so I really see and charge the students with understanding that they are living a legacy and that they are really the rewards of that kind of activism, especially in a Black Lives Matter moment. That before we had that hashtag or Twitter or social media, we had Black activists in Philadelphia writing letters and marching around a wall so that we can indeed have a commencement where you can look out in the audience and see a school of 200 some odd people with all of these beautiful brown and Black kids.
And let's note that when you were there, it had barely been 25, 30 years since the college was
Correct.
Desegregated.
Correct.
I believe 1968.
You're exactly right.
And now there's a Black headmaster.
Isn't that crazy? You know, as the phrase goes around the way, won't he do it? You know.
Let's note that the subtitle of your book referencing the Philadelphia Negro comes directly from a book written about a century or more earlier from Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois.
Correct. Part of what I wanted to do with that, and it was originally my dissertation when I was a graduate student at Northwestern University, and part of what I was really curious about is this is the first major work of American sociology. It also happens to be written by the first Black PhD from Harvard, and it also happens to be about Black people in Philadelphia in a neighborhood that I'm very familiar with because I grew up at 12th and Christian, so very close to it. And so I really had a very simple sort of whodunit mystery idea behind it. The book is 1899, and of course it's 2005 when I'm in Chicago thinking about this, and it made me think, what happened to this neighborhood? How did it go from the only place Black people could live to a place where Black people can barely visit, depending on what day of the week it is and how people feel about their presence there? And so what I found, and this is where the title Black City Makers, the City Makers part is quite significant, is that Black people are actively involved in shaping what we call Philadelphia, actively involved in all sorts of decisions from banking to public housing to the development of 95 and I-76 to the development of a Black political infrastructure, John Street, Milton Street, Wilson Good. All of these folks come from, I would say, or Du Bois's language, a spiritual striving towards some kind of freedom. And so Black City Makers is really thinking about Philadelphia or urban America more generally as something that actively involves minority residents, so that when we think about the problems of cities, we don't just sort of think about them as background noise. They're actually, in many ways, sometimes complicit in many of the things that we think are right and wrong with the city that we're in. So it's really to try to bring Black people from the margin to the center of the conversation and then understand how a population that was originally enslaved in Philadelphia came to wind up having mayors. You know, I think that's a very powerful story. And in many ways, very similar to places like Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles, Seattle, New Orleans, you know, these places where Black people had long time been residents, but hadn't quite been powerful enough to be the mayor. And we see that happening in a lot of places at the same time.
We've had several Black mayors since Wilson Good in 1983.
Correct.
Have we evolved even more so that there is now a white mayor again in Philadelphia, still the same black majority voting bloc.
Right. Well, I mean, I would like to think that it demonstrates that just because you're black doesn't mean black people are going to vote for you. You know, black people are more savvy than that, you know, so it's great if you're black, of course, but we also care about what your politics are and where your politics are going. And so for me, and there's a line in the show, the legendary show, The Wire, where there's a white mayor running after a black mayor had been mayor for a long time. And so his sort of handler is a black man, and he's talking to him, and he says, I don't know how I'm going to convince all of these black people to vote for me. And he says, black people are used to voting for white people. It's white people who are not used to voting for black people. So part of what I think is fascinating about Philadelphia in terms of the black mayor is black people are always already ready to do that. It was about a broader city coalition, white Philadelphians in particular, believing in black leadership as something that could actually lead the city forward. So that's the kind of, I think, story that's really interesting to me, that, you know, you get a couple of black mayors, and then we have, of course, Ed Rendell, then you get John Street, you have Michael Nutter, and now Keeney is the new mayor. And so I think it's just a larger picture. I think Philadelphia is a representation of America's first city, which means that it's full of America's early problems and possibilities. And I like this transition that you're seeing, where it isn't so much about, oh, you definitely have to be black. I think black people in Philadelphia and other places care more about your politics, you know, and hoping that you're doing things that actually help address a lot of the issues and concerns that they have.
Your book is stressing again this active role, the city makers, the city agents, but that active role ultimately led to the demise of that 7th district and the departure throughout various other neighborhoods in the city.
Correct. Thank you for that. Yeah, it's to say, and I use the analogy of Spider-Man a lot because I think it's a easily accessible analogy, and that is for people who are familiar with the Marvel superhero Spider-Man. He's science genius who's bitten by some transformed spider, and he becomes all powerful. And only certain people know that this happens, including his Uncle Ben. And when Uncle Ben finds out that he can do these things, he's sort of like, oh my gosh, what should I do? Should I just keep it to myself? And his uncle says, with great power comes great responsibility. And so I bring that up to say that that's exactly what the point of City Makers is. It isn't this completely, you know, sort of story that sort of whitewashes everything. So all the black people are amazing and great, and all the white people are terrible and horrible. Something more complicated. And it's also to say, for a city that is now almost, if not a majority black city, or a chocolate city, as I refer to it now, is for us to be thinking about our current situations as not just what white people have done, but one, what we've allowed them to do, meaning we voted for particular people. Also, the ways in which black leaders have made deals with people.
You grew up in Philadelphia, but have also spent time in New Haven, Yale, yes, and now Los Angeles. All cities with substantial black communities.
Yes.
Each city, Philadelphia's DNA is unique to Philadelphia.
Right.
Ditto New Haven,
right.
Ditto Los Angeles. Having said that, are there also commonalities that bridge each of the cities?
Yeah, thank you for that question. That's actually the topic of my next book called Chocolate Cities that I'm writing with Professor Zandria Robinson, who's at Rhodes College in Memphis. And basically, the continuity, and this is something that we're both on. She's a brilliant scholar of the urban Black South, and I think I am a good scholar of the urban Black North. And so we thought, we put our collective magic together, what could we find? And what we found is that a lot of times when we study communities, no matter what the race is, we think about all these differences. And so what we are actually finding are continuities that really come out of something that Malcolm X says in 1964 in the ballot or the bullet speech that he gives, where he says, stop talking to me about the South. I don't want to hear about the South. If you're born in the North, you're born in jail. Just like if you're born in the South, you're born in jail. Everywhere below Canada is the South. And so part of the continuity, I've lived in Chicago, I lived in New York, I've lived in Philadelphia, New Haven, and now Los Angeles, and spent some time in the Bay, is that what I actually, and I've been going all across the United States for the last 3 years, going to these black enclaves and talking with great migrants, because the South is everywhere black people are. And in fact, maybe there is a different map of the U.S. we should be using when we're understanding the black experience and where black people are. So what we're doing in the book, we're saying there is a black map of the U.S. where there is no Northeast, there's no Southeast, there's no Midwest, there's no Northwest, there's no West Coast. It's up South, down South, deep South, out South, mid South, west South. And basically it means that, one, the South has followed Black people wherever they have gone. From the moment they could leave freely, Black people have migrated across the U.S., but the South, as a system of oppression and a system of racism and segregation, you know, we think about restrictive covenants, we think about mass incarceration, has followed Black people no matter what regional area we think they're in, since we think the North is a safe spot. The second thing is that Black people bring the South with them. So one continuity that Zandria and I always see is there is this very interesting Southernness everywhere Black people are, right? It's not always the same South because, of course, Black people who are in the Northeast, their migratory pattern is from the Carolinas and Georgia. Folks who are in the Midwest and the West, their migratory pattern is through the Delta largely. So those are different Southern territories. But it is to say that Black people do not just leave the South behind the way that the Great Migration narrative will have us believe. They take things that they love about the South with them. For example, you go all across America and you think about migration. There's Harold's Chicken in Chicago, Ezel's Chicken in Seattle, Roscoe's Chicken and Waffles. I love them in Los Angeles. You know that even if it's something simple like that, it is some continuity of experience. Soul food as this representation of Black people bringing the South with them, much like Polish immigrants bring Poland with them when they arrive in America, much like I'm from South Philly. Italians brought Italy with them to South Philly, you know.
It's portable.
Right, exactly. And that's a piece that I think gets missed because we think about the South as this bad evil that is within six states. And if you're outside of those six states, then you're not in the South at all. And that is not, I think, true or aligns with what the Black American experience looks like. I mean, Flint, Michigan, Michigan is all the way up at the Great Lakes. And I think I'm right in saying that there's better water available in Natchez, Mississippi than there is in Flint, Michigan. It's just to say the South is everywhere Black people are.
What an interesting concept to rethink of the South as south of Canada.
Right.
Maybe that proposed wall is on the wrong border.
Right, they're right. And I always think about that border part is like, no one cares about who's coming in and out of Canada. You know, like it's, I also, there's a racial contour to that, you know?
Marcus, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Dr.
Marcus Anthony Hunter, Associate Professor of Sociology at UCLA and author of the book Black City Makers, How the Philadelphia Negro Changed Urban America.